Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia. It's a cool and somewhat cloudy day here. And today we're going to go and talk about a period of 4 months that occurred back in 1960 that completely revolutionized the science and the art, if you will, of strategic reconnaissance and intelligence gathering. That 4 months comprised a series of incidents and achievements unlike anything that had previously happened in the world of intelligence gathering. And today we have two very fine experts who can talk to us about it. The first, who is on already, is Dr. Jeffrey Richelson of the National Security Archive, where he is a senior fellow and analyst, as well as the author of a number of extremely fine books on remote sensing, technical intelligence, and other things. Jeff, are you there today?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and hopefully we can get Gary on here. I have a funny feeling he may be somewhat out of it at the moment, but we're going to try and bring him on. Let me start by asking, talk a little bit about where the science of technical intelligence gathering was in the 1950s and the advances that we made during the second half of that decade that took us to early 1960, where we're going to be talking about today, if you will.
Right. Sure. Well, actually, you can really go back farther than that. The work of the Wright brothers led eventually to the use of airplanes for reconnaissance purposes. And that particularly was evident first in World War I and then even more so in World War II. And with the advent of the Cold War, there was a need for the U.S. to gather intelligence on what was going on in the Soviet Union, which was certainly not very communicative of what it was doing in terms of the military area. And for that, the U.S. really only had some remodeled bombers to either jump into Soviet territory quickly and take some photographs or to get them to turn on their radars where those signals could be intercepted from ground stations. That clearly was not going to be satisfactory. And in the early 1950s, 1954, a panel convened for President Eisenhower, the Technological Capabilities Panel, made a couple of recommendations, several recommendations. One was to develop a very dedicated spy plane, which was what became the U-2. And that they first began work on that in late 1954, early 1955, and by the summer of 1956, that was able to overfly the Soviet Union. And it did
now,
so
on. Now, this panel that you're talking about, these were not just ordinary men having a meeting in a Boston, cigar bar. This was some of the finest minds of our time. Give a few of the names that we associate with that organization.
James Killian, for one. Edwin Land, who was the founder of Polaroid and played an instrumental role in the development of a number of reconnaissance satellites, up to the ones that we are using today for imagery purposes. So these were people who were President Eisenhower's present or future science advisors, were top people in the field. James Baker, another person involved. So these were the people at the top of their field in scientific endeavors that could be used for intelligence purposes. And so they recommended, among other things, a plane that became known as the U-2 and was able to penetrate Soviet territory, overfly certain parts of the Soviet Union on 23 occasions prior to May 1st, 1960, and bring back very new intelligence, very important intelligence, very high-resolution imagery, that, among other things, led to the end of the bomber gap, the fear that the Soviets had exceeded the U.S. by a significant margin in their bomber capabilities.
Now, we don't, most of us who have any memory of Eisenhower, and you and I are old enough to at least remember him as a childhood memory,
right?
They don't think of Eisenhower as this visionary, world-changing individual who saw space and the upper atmosphere as a means of keeping America safe, of using those high ground as a means of providing national security and keeping the military budget under control. And yet he was. I know you've written a bit about this. Please talk a little bit about Dwight Eisenhower at this point.
Well, even before he came into office, there was investigations into the possibility of, say, using space for reconnaissance purposes going back to 1946 and RAND, but their technology wasn't really there. And he was very concerned with knowing what exactly the Soviet Union was up to, what capabilities they had, how much the U.S. really needed to spend and build in terms of defense versus what would be just excess and waste. And so he approved projects like the U-2. He also approved an Air Force program to develop a reconnaissance satellite. And when those things were not going when that program was not going terribly well, he also approved the CIA program, which became known as Corona, to develop a reconnaissance satellite. And he also, along with Alan Dulles, who was his DCI, approved a number of other programs. Some of these were on-the-ground programs like intelligence radars to really gather information on what the Soviet Union was doing in missiles and nuclear weapons. And if one looks at the intelligence estimates over the 1950s up through the early 1960s, one sees a rather dramatic increase in what the U.S. knew about Soviet capabilities. And so he approved all those systems, plus he also approved the system which he doesn't get usually associated with because it didn't start operating until the Kennedy administration, which was a program known as Gambit, which was the first high-resolution satellite reconnaissance system.
And, of course, during his tenure, when they were looking at replacing the U-2, they also began development of a supersonic stealthy aircraft to replace the U-2, a little thing called the A-12, which we know today as the Blackbird.
Yes, he approved a project in 1958 called Gusto, which was to look at a replacement for the U-2, and it was more than a replacement. It was a much different plane in terms of it being able to fly higher, much, much faster, and over Mach 3, and be able to hopefully be undetectable by Soviet radars, which, as a matter of fact, it was able to be detected, and because of the U-2 shoot-down was never used, but the Air Force version of that, which was a two-seater plane, became known as the SR-71, and provided a lot of valuable intelligence over 20 years in which it was in operation.
Okay. So you have President Eisenhower actively reaching to go and fill in the gaps about what we know about the Soviet Union. And let's talk a little bit about where he was in the spring of 1960, because over those last 5 years of the 1950s, from the period where Nikita Khrushchev took over for Premier Joseph Stalin and early 1960, there had been a radical shift in U.S.-Soviet relations that had happened, correct?
Well, certainly with the death of Stalin, the news of the Khrushchev speech denouncing Stalin that eventually became known to the world, there was some hope that the Cold War would not stay as cold as it had been.
And in 1959, of course, Khrushchev made his famous trip to America, touring everything from Disneyland to a corn farm. And things were starting to look a little better. There were thoughts in the air that maybe the Cold War could cool off to the point where it wouldn't even be a Cold War. Correct?
Well, certainly there were some, I guess hopes that would happen.
And this, of course, was going to include a summit in Paris between the big four powers, and a planned visit by President Eisenhower to visit the Soviet Union in the spring of 60 as well. I mean, these are all the moves that you see when countries want to stop being enemies, right?
Well, it's at least on the surface what you see. Whether when we get into the consequences of the U-2 shootdown, that's a question to raise, whether things would have changed.
Very good. And Jeff, one last question before we go to Gary, who has just finally come on. What kind of a target for intelligence gathering was the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s? I mean, we sometimes forget now, almost a quarter century after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Soviet Union was a very, very closed place to Western eyes and ears.
It was extremely closed. There was very little, or virtually no, human intelligence from clandestine sources available during that time. The U.S. tried whatever means it could to gather intelligence on what was going on. It included attachés on the roofs of buildings, photographing aircraft as they flew by on parade, involved recruiting travelers to take pictures as they were on trains traveling through the Soviet Union. It even included people from Air Force intelligence walking on the beaches of Alaska, waiting for stuff to float up from the Soviet Union, and analyzing every syringe and everything else that happened to arrive on the Alaskan shores. And at the same time, this was just nibbling at the margins, because the Soviet Union was a vast country with a very effective secret police and a lot of different installations in the interior, which the U.S. had no real access to.
And, of course, part of the reason for this was, and I will give credit to our Russian friends who had a little reason to be paranoid, they'd kind of gotten invaded a couple of times by Napoleon, Frederick the Great, Adolf Hitler. I mean, they had reason to fear external influences and forces in their mind, correct?
Well, they also had a general. You also had a government with a unwillingness to reveal much of anything it was doing. Sort of in a way, secrecy was a fundamental part of their remaining in power. So there was both whatever historical reasons there were, plus the very nature of the regime that were drivers of secrecy.
Okay, and now that we've finally gotten him on, let's introduce our second guest, Francis Gary Powers Jr., the director of the Cold War History Museum and the son of the U-2 pilot who was shot down on May 1st. Gary, are you with us? Hello, Gary. Hang on one second. Let's just try this again.
Can you hear me?
Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Very good. Sorry for the difficulties in getting you on this morning, but we're glad we've got you. And we're talking about the Soviet Union right now, and you knowing the son of Nikita Khrushchev, Sergei, rather well. Tell us a little bit about the leader of the Soviet Union at this time, Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev. What was his background, and what kind of a man was he as he led the Soviet Union into the spring of 1960?
Well, Khrushchev was one of Stalin's disciples. He rose up through the ranks, got into the Communist Party as a young man, did a lot of work on behalf of Stalin on his rise to power, and eventually became in control of the Soviet Union. So here he is in 1960, a few years into his term, and he is trying to set the stage, the world stage, to show the world that the Soviet Union is a superpower, is an equal to the United States and not a subordinate or a lesser power nation. So he's trying to show the world that the Soviets are as strong and as powerful and as important as the United States is at this time.
Very good. Jeff?
Yes.
We created the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947 out of the ashes of multiple intelligence failures in World War II, and even grew it due to subsequent failures in Korea. What was the thing that CIA was charged with during this period from the late 40s into the 60s? What was the primary thing that they were supposed to do and never allow to happen again?
Well, I mean, the top of the list was America being subject to a surprise attack, as in Pearl Harbor. So it's, if you say its primary objective was to gather and analyze intelligence about the Soviet Union that would preclude the U.S. being subject to a first strike, or also being in a position where the Soviet Union had such a preponderance of military power that the U.S. was in a position not to be a position where it couldn't resist Soviet initiatives in Europe or elsewhere.
So, in other words, it was supposed to warn of enemy attack and at the same time provide an assay, a regular series of assays on what was the state of Soviet bombers, missiles, and nuclear weapons development, you're saying?
Yes. I mean, the first question that a defector would be asked during that period of time when he spoke to the CIA was, do you know of any impending attacks? On a day-to-day basis, there wasn't any information generally for the CIA to have, since there weren't any planned surprise attacks. But on a daily basis, it sought to gather intelligence by both technical and human and means about what the Soviet capabilities were, what they were planning to build, and that would be sort of part of the basis of warning of any surprise attack.
Now, obviously, this was done through the 1950s by the U-2s, other aircraft that would fly along the periphery of the Soviet Union or occasionally dash in. But these all had the possibility of being shot down and made into an incident. What was the advantage in the mind of Eisenhower to moving these key strategic missions of photo reconnaissance and electronic intelligence into space-based systems aboard satellites?
Well, in the early years, you weren't going to get exactly the same intelligence from satellites, particularly imagery satellites, than from, say, the U-2, because the resolution wouldn't be as good. But as part of the development in terms of intelligence collection, a satellite couldn't be shot down at that time. They weren't going to be subject to being destroyed by a surface-to-aircraft missile. They could cover far more territory than a U-2. I mean, in July of 1960, the U-2 had been judged by the CIA to have covered a little 7.5% of the Soviet landmass in its imagery, because it had been only on 23 missions. It was flying at an altitude that limited compared to a satellite to how much it could encompass in a single photograph. And so with satellites, you could fly them more frequently. You could fly them without any feared loss of life or plane being shot down. You could cover more targets. So you could build up over a very short period of time a much better picture of what was happening across the Soviet Union than you could with U-2 missions, because they were those had to be limited by the number of pilots you had, how much risk you could take, and Soviet air defense capabilities. So while the U-2 led to the end of the bomber gap, it was the Corona missions that led to the end of the missile gap.
Now, it needs to be said that today we take for granted that we fly things into space and usually they get there. The late 1950s, especially when, like, 58, 59, when Eisenhower made the decision to go ahead and begin doing space-based intelligence gathering and reconnaissance, things weren't quite so easy. Rockets weren't so reliable, and things more often than not did not work, correct?
It was just as likely that the thing would blow up on a launch pad or land in the ocean than it would actually take its payload into space. And the first 12 Discovery missions, for one reason or another, produced nothing. In some cases, there were no cameras on board, but there were other problems when there were. And a capsule wasn't recovered until the 13th mission, which didn't actually have a camera on board. It wasn't until the 14th mission, about 18 months after they started the actual launches, that you actually got imagery of the Soviet Union.
Now, we'll get back to that story here in a couple minutes, but let's talk about the very last attempt to fly a U-2 mission over the Soviet landmass. And, Gary, this is a little thing called Operation Grand Slam, and your dad was tasked with going and flying it. Now, he had flown missions over the Soviet Union before, correct?
Yes. Let me back up just a little bit to set the stage for the May 1st mission. Back in 1955 that we were just talking about, Eisenhower had proposed to Khrushchev the open skies policy. At the time, he presented to Khrushchev this idea that we could overfly their land, their country, they could overfly ours, they could take pictures of our areas, we could take pictures of theirs, so that each nation would know that the other side was not preparing for a surprise attack. Khrushchev at the time said no. He did not want to participate in this open skies policy. To the Americans, that was a red flag. Oh, they have something to hide. They're preparing for a war. They're preparing to surprise attack us. But to the Soviets, and I've heard this directly from Khrushchev's son, Sergei, is that his father said no to the open skies policy, not because they had something to hide, but it's what they didn't have that they wanted to hide. They didn't have the missiles they were boasting. They didn't have the bombers they were boasting. And so Khrushchev was fearful that if the Americans found out that they were not as strong as his claims, that they could then prepare for a surprise invasion or catch them off guard. So as a result of that, in 1955, Eisenhower authorizes the creation of the U-2 program. Over the next few years, it is developed and implemented. The selection process takes place through the U.S. Air Force that recruits U.S. Air Force pilots with select abilities in the number of hours in a single jet aircraft, their mental stability, their past performance within the military, and they basically get the cream of the crop. My father is one of these pilots who was recruited by the CIA in 1955 to fly the secret missions. Between 1955 and 1960, my dad flies a total of 26 missions. Some are over the Soviet Union, some are over China, India, Pakistan, Middle East, countries in the Eastern European reign that we are trying to get information from. Then on May 1st, 1960, my dad is selected to fly the first mission across the entire width of the Soviet Union. It's approximately 2,700 miles in length, taking off from Peshawar, Pakistan, flying over various military industrial complexes over the Soviet Union on to a landing field in Buda, Norway. My father gets up very early on May 1st in the morning. He has his briefing. He's put into the cockpit. It's delayed. They are waiting for presidential authorization. Eisenhower finally gives the signal, gives the go-ahead, and my father takes off on his May 1st mission. He's halfway across the Soviet Union. He's over a city called Sverdlovsk. He's just made an adjustment in his course heading when there's a bright orange flash that lights up the exterior of the cockpit of the airplane. A shockwave hits the plane, pushes it forward. As the result, my father could no longer control the airplane. The yoke did not respond to his will. The nose pitches forward. The wings snap off. And my father finds himself spinning down towards the ground in the wreckage. He falls from 70,500 feet to an altitude of approximately 30,000 feet before bailing out of the aircraft. He does not use the ejection seat. He basically crawls out of the airplane. Had he used the ejection seat, he would have severed his legs off. Because of the way the airplane was falling, the centrifugal force, my father was not in a position to use the ejection seat properly. If he did, he would have severed his legs. Realizing this, he does the following. He opens up the canopy, which floats off into space, undoes his harness, and is immediately sucked up halfway out of the airplane. He is no longer able to reach the destruct mechanism that's on the dashboard of the cockpit. He realizes he's getting closer and closer to the ground. He breaks free the air hose that's holding him in place. He falls free of the aircraft, and his parachute opens automatically at 15,000 feet. He parachutes down to the ground, where he's apprehended, caught by the Soviet authorities, and then turned over to the KGB, who later that afternoon take him by airplane, a transport plane, to downtown Moscow, to Lubyanka prison, where he finds himself imprisoned his first night of captivity on May 1st of 1960.
Now, this mission, what was codenamed Grand Slam, was probably going to be one of the last U-2 deep penetration missions because they knew that surface-to-air missiles were getting to be a problem and that the U-2 was vulnerable. What was the ultimate target that they wanted to find on this mission that was really key in trying to understand the Soviet nuclear strike capabilities?
Well, one of the specific targets was an SA-2, a surface-to-air missile base near Sverdlovsk, that on the April 9th mission had been photographed. So as part of my dad's mission on May 1st, he was told to go this certain route take pictures of certain bases that were on their hit list, and then to fly over Sverdlovsk to take pictures of the SA-2 battery to see if it was operational. Well, Dad found out firsthand that it was operational, but was not able to report that because he had been shot down.
And, of course, they were trying to also take a look at where they suspected the very first Soviet ICBM base was north of Moscow at a place called Plotetsk, correct?
Yes, that was one of their targets, as well as other submarine bases, nuclear testing facilities, the rocket launch pad where they would launch their Sputniks from, and other military bases en route between Peshawar and Norway.
Okay. Jeff, back to you real quick. What kind of effect does the shoot down, which is made public immediately by Khrushchev, have both on U.S. intelligence gathering and publicly in terms of its effect on the Cold War itself?
Well, in terms of intelligence gathering, it leads to the immediate end of the U-2 missions and increases the urgency to get a satellite into space that would actually work. So the U.S. has now lost, with the U-2 shoot down, the ability to overfly any part of the Soviet Union, really, and therefore it has to hope and work on getting the Coronas up into space and working. In terms of the Cold War, it, at least on the surface, meant that the summit didn't take place because Khrushchev wanted an apology from Eisenhower, which he was not willing to give. Eisenhower defended the program as necessary, and so that summit, you know, didn't take place. Whether that actually had any real long-term effect on the Cold War is another question. You would have to assume that somehow if that summit took place, there wouldn't have been a Cuban Missile Crisis or there wouldn't have been an invasion of Czechoslovakia. And I don't know that you can really say that, but certainly in the short term, on the surface, it increased tensions and led to this cancellation of the summit.
Now,
and also, if I may, you have to remember, the listening audience, that in 1959, Eisenhower had invited Premier Khrushchev over to America, where he visited cornfields and he had tours of some of our manufacturing plants and was a guest of our country. And the May 14th summit conference, after that had collapsed, Khrushchev uninvited Eisenhower from attending a similar reception over in the former Soviet Union, where Eisenhower was invited by Khrushchev to come over in reciprocation for the hospitality that was shown here in America. Eisenhower was scheduled to go to the Soviet Union after the May 14th summit conference, not directly after, but a few months after. And as a result of the U-2 incident, not only did the summit conference collapse, because as Jeff had said, Eisenhower refused to apologize, but also his trip to the Soviet Union was derailed, and it caused some heightened tensions.
Jeff, there's an old saying that says these are the times that try men's souls. Dwight Eisenhower was not a young man. He was less than a year from retiring and going out of public life, per se. He would have been probably perfectly justified in going and, pulling back and just not taking any risks. That's what we certainly expect of politicians today.
Mm-hmm.
What did Eisenhower do when he got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, intelligence-wise? What was his response privately and behind the scenes?
Well, in a way, it was the outcome was what he had already predicted, which was earlier on in the program, he said that one day one of these things are going to get shot down and that he would be, embarrassed. I forget what the exact words he used were, but he certainly continued on with the Corona program, which would hopefully avoid or certainly avoid the type of problems that resulted from the shooting down to the U-2. I think it also should be noted that he was very cautious in some ways. When it came to the U-2, he had to approve flights. He didn't want it those missions to occur so frequently that they increased the risk of being shot down or increased the tensions with the Soviet Union. And when it came to the GRAB satellite, the satellite that collected intelligence on Soviet radars, he required very strict limits on how often it could be used, both in terms of not being used on successive passes over the Soviet Union and not being used on successive days. So there was certainly an element of caution to Eisenhower's supervision of these intelligence activities, but at the same time, he did approve the U-2 and missions, and he did approve Corona and continuing on with it.
Now let's talk about that satellite that you just mentioned, because the very day that he had to admit that, yes, the U-2 was a spy plane, and yes, it was on an intelligence-gathering mission over the Soviet Union, sometime that same day, he put his signature on approval for something called Project Dino, also known as GRAB, which was a specialized electronic intelligence gathering satellite being developed by the Naval Research Lab and the NSA. Talk a little bit about what that program was doing and what it was intended to give back in the way of information.
Right. Well, in a way, the origins of that program are very different from the imagery satellites in that there was engineer for the Naval Research Labs named Reed Mayo was coming back from a trip with his family, and they were stranded by a snowstorm. So sitting in a Howard Johnson's in Pennsylvania, he worked out the mathematics of could you put a intercept receiver on a satellite and use that to intercept Soviet radar signals, which was a topic they were concerned about. And he concluded yes, and that led the Navy to propose and receive approval for this program, which would go after the emanations from Soviet radars. The U.S. had been relying on ferret flights into the Soviet periphery or on the Soviet periphery and triggering radars that would send out signals that would be intercepted by ground stations in England and otherwise. But as I said before, the Soviet Union is a very large country with a lot of radars. And the idea of putting a receiver on a satellite meant that you could hopefully cover the entire Soviet Union and detect all the different types of radars, air defense, early warning, and so forth, particularly the early warning radars. And one advantage was that if you compared the footprint of a electronic intelligence satellite like GRAB to an aircraft was that the footprint for GRAB was about 3,800 miles, meaning it could intercept a signal from anywhere within that sort of area, whereas a aircraft, even if it had been able to fly over the Soviet Union, which of course it couldn't, would have been restricted to about 450 miles. So it was a major step forward in being able to monitor and chart the entire Soviet radar network, particularly the early warning network.
And so we have this today legendary bit of intelligence technology history where on a dark and stormy night, I actually used the term, an engineer scribbles on the back of a Howard Johnson's placemat the concept that becomes Ferret satellites that we still use today, delivers it to his boss, and today somewhere in a warehouse in Maryland, probably next to the Ark of the Covenant, there is this paper placemat which has this unique place in American intelligence history.
Yes.
Okay, so the president gives his approval to go ahead and literally still stinging from having, you know, to admit that that we got caught spying, he's signing up a brand new program ready to go and to take it out. Now, this satellite was a little unique in that it was not a satellite unto itself. It used what we call a piggyback concept, whereas it basically was attached to a unclassified civilian payload. And this is a common technique now, correct?
Well, there are certainly a lot of satellites that have more than one mission, either in the intelligence world or elsewhere. So you were able to the GRAB package, the actual equipment was only about 40 pounds. So you could attach that to something else, essentially do two or more missions for the cost of one launch, and also provide cover. So you didn't have to explain what this strange satellite being launched into low Earth orbit was. You had a sort of very benign explanation for it.
And this is the classic CIA technique of hiding something in plain sight.
Yes.
Okay, and historically we know that the very first one was attached to a satellite package called Transit, which was an experimental Navy navigation satellite. And the second one went on the back of a radiation and background energy research packet put together by the famous Jim Van Allen, who the radiation belts are named after. What happens when the first two of these satellites are launched in June of 1961?
June of 1960, actually.
60. I mean, how do they perform, and what is the general consensus opinion about what they managed to accomplish?
Well, I think there was a certain number of successes and failures, as you would expect in these early programs. But what they start doing is providing information on radars like the Token and Gage, early warning radars that the U.S. wants to know about. So you identify locations. You also get information like pulse duration, pulse repetition. And this is all part of both producing intelligence estimates on Soviet early warning capabilities, but also this is information that goes into the war plan. I mean, this was something that the Strategic Air Command was very interested in terms of building the PSYOP, the Strategic Integrated Operational Plan, which was the U.S. nuclear war plan, because had there been a war, these radars would have been targeted for elimination, either by electronic means or by physical destruction. PSYOP is a single integrated operation plan.
And historically, these were the first two successful intelligence gathering satellites ever orbited for the purpose of strategic reconnaissance, as it were.
Well, so the June 60 beat Corona into orbit by a couple of months.
And but also, when you say successful, it's my understanding that the first few satellites that were launched were not retrievable, they didn't catch the film, and that the first successful capture took place with the Corona launch that was captured by a mid-air trajectory on August 17th of 1960. And that was the
first time that they'd actually gotten
the film back for analysis.
And we will talk more about that after we talk a little bit, Gary, about what your dad was doing with his summer vacation at that point.
Yes. Well, Dad, after being shot down May 1st, was imprisoned. He went through approximately 3 months, 90 days of interrogations at Lubyanka, which is the infamous KGB prison, part of and adjacent to the KGB headquarters in downtown Moscow. During that 3 months of interrogations, there was no physical torture, but there was a lot of mental anguish, bright spotlights, grueling questions, threats of death, sleep deprivation, trying to confuse him, trying to get him to spill his guts, trying to get him to tell them everything they wanted to know. My father, during these 3 months of interrogations, during the first 7 days, he was lying to his captors outright, misleading them any way he could. But then on May 7th, international headlines around the world, the KGB interrogator comes into the jail cell, the interrogation room, shoves the newspaper, a New York Times, in my father's face, yells at him, saying, "You've lied to us. You told us that you were trained in Arizona. Well, the New York Times says you were trained in Nevada at Area 51. You might as well tell us everything. We'll get it out of your American press anyways." So all of a sudden, my dad's stuck between a rock and a hard place. If he tells the full truth, he's giving away secrets. If he lies to them and gets caught, he could get shot, face the death penalty for espionage. So for the next 3 months, he does a little bit of a cat and mouse technique, where he tells the full truth when he knows they can verify the information in the press, but he misleads them when he can, when he knows there's no way they can verify if what he's telling them is true or not, such as the names of the pilots, the number of missions, specifications about the equipment on board. My dad, during the interrogations, always basically has played dumb. "I'm a pilot. I was hired to fly this airplane. I don't know what this piece of equipment does." But in fact, all of the U-2 pilots knew exactly what each piece of the equipment on board did, was for, how it was used, and in case there was trouble with it in flight, they could try to repair it, fix it, or get it to work by going around the back door somehow. So Dad just did his best to conceal as much as he could, told the truth when he knew they could verify it, that would give him credibility, and made it through this ordeal. Then
now,
August 17th... Go ahead.
Yeah, and I should point out that once the interrogation was finished, he finds out that he's going to be put on trial in Moscow, a show trial, as it were, for espionage. Correct?
Yes, that is correct. So during this time period, my father finds out that he is going to be tried under a certain article of the Soviet's law for espionage. The trial date is set up in the Hall of Columns, which is the same, for lack of a better word, an auditorium that were used during the Stalin purges back in the 30s when he would do the show trials in that same location. And so my dad, on August 17th, is the start of the trial. It's his 31st birthday, and it also happens to be the date of the first successful Corona satellite retrieval. So this all takes place on August 17th. For 3 days, the trial goes on. As a result, my father is found guilty of espionage and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
But meanwhile, back in the United States, Corona is finally coming to fruition. A final developmental mission is flown, known as Discoverer 13, which doesn't have a camera, but of course has an American flag, which Eisenhower proudly shows off as part of the first object recovered from space. And Jeff, Tell us the story of Discoverer 14, mission 909 of the Corona program.
Well, that launches from California, and unlike all the other missions where there was always some problem that emerged, and it was always seemed to be a different problem, which Richard Bissell, who was the CIA director of the program, noted was particularly frustrating since you couldn't really know what was going to go wrong next. This one puts the payload into space, and it starts photographing targets in the Soviet Union, the first being an airbase called Mishmita, which became sort of the standard first image for subsequent satellites, satellite programs.
And sort of the calibration target, as it were.
Well, it's the first target of the Soviet Union. So it's the first thing that has a chance of providing intelligence. And over the course of its rotations, it makes seven passes over the Soviet Union. Satellite is ejected, and the capsule containing the film is ejected, and then it is eventually recovered and then brought back for analysis. And that when the film gets back to Washington, there is a meeting at the CIA's Photographic Intelligence Center. This was before there was what became known as the National Photographic Interpretation Center. And normally for U-2 missions, they would lift the curtain for the photo interpreters, and they would see the single line which described the path of the U-2 mission. And then they would know where the plane was over, and over which targets it was over and what it was photographing. And then they would go to work. This time, the deputy director of the intelligence center said, "We have something new and special tonight." And they lifted the curtain, and what they saw were seven bars over the Soviet Union. And they all knew that this meant that this was satellite photography, and that they had the capability of looking at the Soviet Union from space. And they all broke out to applause, and then eventually they went to work. And that one mission yielded more photographs, over 1,400, than had been available before, and covered more territory than all the U-2 missions combined. Of course, it should also be noted that the resolution of those photographs was not nearly what the U-2 photographs brought back. And today would be considered, horrid resolution, but it was a major step in being able to cover the Soviet interior and a step along the way in developing even better space reconnaissance capabilities.
And give people an idea, what were the things that had to work to make this go? I mean, obviously you have the Delta launch vehicle, but then you have the first successful use of something we would now call a GINA, a trans stage that could light and fire more than multiple times, a camera that operates in a vacuum, film that functions in a vacuum, and a recovery system which guarantees that nobody can get it but us. Talk a little bit about these features.
Well, I think you described it pretty well. You have to get the thing off the launch pad, get it into out of the atmosphere. You have to put the satellite in the right orbit. The camera, everything has to be facing in the right direction. The film has to pass through. The film has to record the targets, then has to go into the spool or the reel, essentially, where it's all stored. You have to then eject the capsule at the right moment so that it comes down over the right area of the world. And then you have to recover the target either through snatching it out of the air, or if it hits the ocean, recovering it from the ocean. And all those things had gone wrong in the past in one way or another. Things blew up on the launch pad. The camera didn't work. In some cases, the capsule was ejected into too high an orbit and stayed there, or it came down in the wrong part of the world. I mean, there were You had the famous Discoverer 2 mission, which was the basis for the film Ice Station Zebra, where the capsule came down in near Spitsbergen, apparently, and there was suspicions that it was recovered by the Soviet Union. It didn't have any film in it, but still that gave Alistair MacLean the idea for his book Ice Station Zebra. So you had to have a whole series of events happen correctly at a time where you had very little experience in doing this.
And thus, a revolution in intelligence gathering had been accomplished in just 4 months, starting with a major disaster and ending in what could be described as something of a triumph at the time.
Yes, certainly. It was both a dramatic improvement in U.S. intelligence capabilities, but also a step along the way in improving them much, much further.
And to finish up this story we're telling, let's not forget that there was a man in a Soviet jail at this point. Gary, what happened? Give us a short explanation of what happened to your dad over the next couple of years.
Well, sure. After the trial on August 17th, it ended August 20th, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He started to serve that sentence in Vladimir. Vladimir prison is 3 hours outside of Moscow. At that facility, he had a cellmate, a Latvian, whose name was Zergard Krimish. He explains to my father that he was caught smuggling goods and people in and out of Latvia while working for the British. Zergard was a very smart individual. He spoke five or six different languages and was selected to be my dad's prison mate because he spoke English. My father, when he met Zergard, of course, his first instinct was, who is this guy? He must be a Soviet plant. Anything I say will be repeated. So this added a little bit of stress to his stay in the Soviet Union. But Zergard and my father did become friends, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's hard not to get to know somebody when you're in an 8-foot by 12-foot cell 24/7. They did help each other endure the hardships. They would read letters to each other that they got from their family. They would share their supplies and their resources, and they really did help each other endure this hardship. My father, fortunately, did not have to spend the full 10 years in prison. He was exchanged February 10th, 1962, a total of 21 months in Soviet captivity. On February 10th of 62, the night before, he was taken by airplane from Moscow down to East Germany and then shuttled over to a safe house. 6 a.m., February 10th, a dark, cold, foggy morning right out of a John Le Carré novel. My father is on one side of the Glenacre Bridge in Potsdam, Germany. Rudolf Abel, a Soviet spy caught in America in the late 50s, is on the other side of the bridge. They are positively ID'd by their respective countries, and they walk home to their respective freedoms. Rudolf Abel returns home to the Soviet Union, a hero of their country, ticker tape parade in his honor, postage stamp in his likeness, medals for his heroics. My father returns home to an American public that doesn't really know what to make of this ordeal. They've read editorials in the newspaper that my father had defected, had landed the plane intact, had spilled his guts and told the Soviets everything he knew, or hadn't followed orders and committed suicide. All of this at the time was misinformation, innuendo, speculation, some outright lies. And so when my father came home to America, he was surrounded with a lot of controversy. There were people in our government and normal citizens who thought that he was less than a hero. My father had to defend himself when he returned home from these false accusations. Dad was debriefed by the CIA, the Air Force, the U.S. government. March 6th of 62, set before a Senate Select Committee hearing where he was exonerated of any wrongdoing and shown, quote, to be a fine young man performing well under dangerous circumstances. But at the time, you have to remember that this was all front page headlines, and what people would read in the newspaper is often the impression they would receive. So even though Dad was exonerated at the time, the misinformation and the stories continued to circulate around, and even to this day continue to do so. So when students or people go to look for information on the U-2 incident, they can go to Google, bring up the front page headlines from 1960, and read all the misinformation of the time. They may not find that in May of 2000, Dad was posthumously awarded with the POW Medal. They may not find that in June of 2012, just last year, Dad was posthumously awarded with the Silver Star by the U.S. Air Force. So the Air Force, the CIA, over the last 50 years have set the record straight, have declassified documents and all the information, not all, but a great sum of information with the U-2 program, especially the U-2 incident one of May 1st, 1960, that shows my father did everything he was supposed to do, that he followed orders, that he did not divulge any information to the Soviets that was critical, and conducted himself according to his obligation as an American.
Okay, and now is that part of the show that we like to do where we let people tell us what they're doing right now. And since I know you have to go first, Gary, tell us a little bit about what you do and what are you working on right now?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I did found the Cold War Museum, coldwar.org, back in 1996 to honor Cold War veterans and preserve Cold War history. A couple of years ago, I stepped off the board of directors. I'm on the advisory board now, and I still help them where I can. But I've moved on to do other projects. I'm consulting in the Richmond, Virginia area. Currently, I'm working on a program, the Quest Lyceum, QUESTLYCEUM.org, for more information. And it is a new educational venue here in Central Virginia that will help students, educators, participants, members, to learn how to invent and how to create, how to think outside of the box, and not how just to regurgitate something that you read in the textbook. They're looking to do hands-on demonstrations to recreate some very famous inventions, such as the Galileo telescope, the Hooke microscope, and the Wright brothers' 1911 glider. So these projects are underway, and we have a bunch of kickoff events coming up at the end of this month that I am helping to organize and promote for the Quest Lyceum Board of Directors.
Well, sounds like a great set of projects you're working on, and thank you for coming on with us. I know you have another event you have to move to, but thanks for sharing your story.
Hey, John, thank you so much. Jeff, a pleasure to meet you over the phone.
Thanks.
And I do look forward to following up with both of you individually here as we go forward.
Excellent. And Jeff, you have had what can only be described as a prolific career as a historian and analyst and researcher. I know your last book that I recall was Spying on the Bomb, in which you sit down and trace the rather complex process of each side going and spying on each other and their efforts to obtain nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. What are your new projects? What are you working on, and what are you doing over at the National Security Archive these days?
Oh, and Jeff and John, I do have to get off the phone for the sixth appointment. Thank you very much. We'll talk later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Jeff?
Yes. Well, I mean, the latest thing that actually has come out is the second edition of my book on the Defense Support Program, the Early Warning Satellites, which has a new chapter that covers events from 1999 to the present, which is the sort of towards the end of the DSP program in a way and the beginning of the follow-on program. I occasionally, for the National Security Archive, post what are known as electronic briefing books, which are collections of documents on particular topics, and the latest one is on cyber warfare and cybersecurity. And the archive can be located at www.nsarchive.org. And as far as ongoing book projects, I'm sort of in the early phases of working on the seventh edition of my book on the U.S. intelligence community, which is scheduled for summer of 2015. And I'm also working on a book on the history of the National Reconnaissance Office. So that'll be the history of the spy satellite program and the office from really 1946 up to the present.
Excellent. So it's nice to know that you're still in the swing and you're still going out there working on that topic area that we all respect you for. Just for those of our listeners who've never heard of the National Security Archive, what is it, where is it, and what is its mission in the world?
Well, it's in Washington, D.C., located at George Washington University. And it's an organization that was started in 1985, 1986, with the mission of sort of being a permanent home for declassified documents and having a capability to pursue declassification of documents concerning various aspects of national security, whether it be U.S. nuclear policy or foreign policy or intelligence, over long stretches of time, much longer than the author of a single particular book would be interested in those documents, since they have a limited timeline. So over its existence, the archive has had a number of conferences in these areas, been active in terms of getting declassified documents declassified, and documents and the Freedom of Information Act being implemented more faithfully. It produces it's produced 25 or so document sets, which are collections of thousands of pages of documents on a particular subject, with guides essays and descriptions of each document. And on its website, it posts these electronic briefing books, of which there are now over 400, concerning the same topics that it covers in terms of document sets. These are collections of anywhere from, say, 15 to 50 or 100 documents on a particular subject that, no charge for that. You can simply go onto the archive website and take a look at those documents in areas that are of interest.
This organization has obviously made full exploitation of the First Amendment for the American citizen a priority. They also are notorious for giving out one of the least desired awards in Washington, D.C., the Rosemary Woods Award. What is that for, and who are some of the people who've gotten it?
Well, I think, unfortunately, for some of the organizations, they might actually be proud of it, which is the problem. But the award is named after, obviously, Richard Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, in the 18-minute gap. But the award is for essentially the worst performance with regard to the Freedom of Information Act for the last year by some government organization. Among the organizations that have won it are both the Air Force and the Department of Justice for their poor performance in that area.
So they're an equal opportunity organization. They'll go ahead and take a swack at anybody.
Yes. There are a large number of agencies that are subject to the Freedom of Information Act, and some of them do very well, and some of them do very poorly, and some of them seem to do very poorly because they want to do very poorly.
Understand. Jeff, I want to thank you for coming on and anchoring this for us today, especially with the problems we had getting Gary on the phone.
Sure.
But good luck in everything you're doing, and please stay in touch, because I've always loved your work, and I've always thought well of what you provide as a lens for the public to go ahead and better understand the intelligence operations and services of this country.
Oh, thank you.
And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this edition of Military Monday. Please come back next week. We will have another show waiting for you. We're hoping to have one on military public affairs and how the professionals in that particular area do their difficult jobs. Until then, this is John Gresham signing off for Military Monday.